Welcome to the Capital Connection, a weekly program questioning New York State leaders on a variety of issues. Your host is Dr. Alan Chartok, political scientist and professor emeritus at the University at Albany. Distribution for the Capital Connection is made possible with the help of New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org.
It's the Capital Connection. Hi, I'm Alan Chartok. Joining this week is an old friend, a wonderful man, the upstate quote. He's on the front page of the New York Times more than he's not. Blair Horner, the executive director of the New York Public Interest Research Group, or NYPIRG. Welcome back, Brother Blair.
Thanks for having me.
I guess the first question we want to know is, what is the governor up to when it comes to having to play the Trump card? And that's interesting because, you know, in Bridge there is Trump and all the rest of that stuff. But he needs to anticipate, right, whether or not the Trump budget, whatever that is, will kill New York State.
New York always has this kind of problem. What's different for this governor is it's the first time in his tenure that he hasn't had a Democratic administration in the White House. And so he's looking more over his shoulder to see what impacts the Trump administration and the Republican-controlled Congress will have on this New York State budget. This sort of emerges, I think, out of his fight with the Congress and the president over the ill-fated effort by them to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare. I mean, prior to that, really hadn't heard anything about from the governor on this issue. He had proposed a budget in January and didn't make he did have built into his budget that he could have mid-year changes in the budget with only his executive authority, and the legislature's rejected that. So part of the fight over this, I think, is the legislature's wish to have more money added to the governor's budget, their opposition to the governor's power that he's proposed to allow him to make changes in the middle of the year without the legislative approval. And you put those two things together, and I think the governor's trying to put pressure on the legislative branch to reduce spending. Just so the listeners all know, the federal budget doesn't go into effect until October. And so the first half of the state's fiscal year, which starts on April 1st in New York, would not be affected, or at least presumably not affected, by anything significant out of Washington.
But Blair Horner, pardon my naivete, but it does seem to me that the governor has had a lot of money to play with. He's been doing initiatives in upstate New York. He's been doing initiatives on transportation. He seems to have a lot of money. Am I mistaken?
Well, I don't think so. I mean, I think you're right that the governor's had a lot of leeway to spend money that he's gotten either squirreled away from previous surpluses or money that the state's gotten as windfalls from various bank settlements and other revenues. But that all being said, you know, the impact that the feds could have a dramatic impact on a state like New York, which has, you know, a lot of significant services, some of which gets at least partially funded by the federal government, if those programs get cut. And that's, I mean, every indication is that the Trump administration and the Congress are going to cut domestic spending. That's going to have an impact on the New York State budget. And the question is, how do you prepare for that? The governor's trying to make an argument to reduce spending now in the final budget negotiations and, you know, adjust it as you go along. I mean, the legislature's back next January. The federal budget goes into effect in October. So there would be a period of time between October and beginning of January where if something dramatic happened, the legislature would have to come back, at least under the way that they're articulating how they want to deal with this. But, you know, again, the executive typically wants to spend less than the legislature, and this also has the collateral benefit, I think, of strengthening the governor's hand in the budget negotiations.
Now, Cuomo has also been talking about a so-called extender bill as opposed to, you know, a whole new budget. What's that all about?
Well, the way it works in New York and probably the rest of the country is that if the state misses its budget deadline, a budget has to be in place. And when New York historically had these late budgets, what they would do is extend the current budget for a period of time, a week, a month, days, whatever. And that has not happened under the Cuomo administration because there's been various court decisions that have strengthened his hand, which makes it much more likely that the legislature capitulates to the executive's budget. So what he's talking about with an extender is if they can't get it done by midnight Friday, that they just kick the can and have some sort of extender that keeps the current budget in place, or, depending what they want to do, the governor could write a different kind of extender and put his proposed budget in place for a longer period of time. We don't know what substantively the governor would propose, but when he's talking about an extender, he's talking about at least some form of a temporary extension of either the current budget or an amended budget that would sort of fill in the gap until the governor and the legislature could come to an agreement on a final budget for the fiscal year starting on April 1st.
Now, Blair Horner, explain this to us. Obviously, the one thing you always hear about in these budget negotiations are the schools. And, you know, if you have an extender, then the amount of money going to the schools basically stays the same,
right,
as opposed to any kind of increase, which the schools who face inflation are always talking about. Plus, they're under some court mandates to do better. Where does education fit in?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I mean, you're right. If you do a budget, if you just merely extend the existing budget for a period of time, it's effectively a cut. Because, as you point out, there's something called inflation. Things cost more this year than they did last year. And if you don't increase the spending on those programs, you're effectively mandating a cut. I think, again, we don't know what kind of extender the governor would advance. He might adjust the extender to increase spending for school districts. He might not. So the process for how this all works out is sort of a moving target. And what the governor could propose to do is a number of different kinds of things. But if it came to school aid and if it was purely an extension of the existing budget, the schools would have to tighten up their belts at least until a final budget was negotiated.
So ride along with me on this one. Tell me about what's going on with Uber.
Well, just so everybody knows, I mean, the budget is about numbers and spending on programs and services to the public. But because it's such a big deal, and because the governor has a lot of leverage in budget negotiations, largely non-budget issues get folded into the discussions. And so there is a proposal to allow for what's called ride sharing outside of the city of New York and upstate New York to basically allow companies like Uber and Lyft and others to basically market their services to people who need rides in places outside of the city of New York. And so but to make that happen, you need to have a law to allow it, and you have to figure out how they're going to be insured and what are the safety measures and who regulates this new industry. And those details are what's holding up the discussion on what to do about ride sharing, but it's part of the budget discussions. And at least as we speak now, there is some sort of feeling that ride sharing could be part of the final budget agreement with some other non-budget issues. But the ride sharing issue, I think, hinges on some of the more fundamental questions of who regulates them. The state Senate wants it, and I believe the governor wants it to be the Department of Motor Vehicles. I believe the assembly wants to leave it up to localities to regulate in the same way that they regulate taxi cabs. And so there are some technical difficulties in terms of the substance of it that have kept the parties apart. And, you know, how that rides out, well, we don't know yet.
Help me with this, Blair. Upstate, downstate is always an issue. So what is the issue here? That along comes John Faso. Remember him? Congressman John Faso, during the great health care debate, he said, well, we're going to make one set of rules for upstate counties. They don't have to pay their share of Medicaid, but New York City does. So we have this upstate, downstate split all the time. Kind of significant, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, it's historical. I mean, it's been like this probably since there was a New Amsterdam and a frontier in upstate New York. There's been a political divide that separates essentially upstate from downstate, and it plays out in a lot of different arenas. Upstate tends to, you know, depending how you define upstate, but basically west of the Hudson Valley is more economically distressed. Stagnant population, not a lot of economic growth. So their problems are different than you have in the Hudson Valley and downstate, where the populations tend to grow and where there tends to be more economic activity. And, you know, how you harmonize the needs and issues of both of those in essentially different kinds of areas creates conflict and also is one of the ways that you try to negotiate a budget. So, again, as you know, upstate has different kinds of problems. So what kinds of things can you do to relieve those problems? Congressman Faso and Congressman Collins' proposal in the ill-fated Trump Care debate was to basically shift the cost of paying for Medicaid from localities to the state. And in doing that, you would help reduce property taxes on the counties and at least theoretically make upstate more appealing for people to live in and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Maybe even stimulate economic development. That's been one of these issues, by the way, that's been kicking around for decades. New York is one of the rare states that actually has a significant requirement for localities to kick in for the cost of Medicaid.
Right. Can you explain something to me? Whether there's ever a chance with this real dissonance between the city and the state that you'd have two states instead of one?
Well, you know, I guess anything's possible, right? I mean, that's where, I guess, North and South Carolina come from, and West Virginia, right? I guess in the Civil War. But, you know, it's a rare thing, and it would require an act of Congress, and, you know, that's a sort of a long and perilous path. But sure, I mean, there are people that make that argument. Upstaters that say we don't want it to have anything to do with New York City. And then there's sometimes people in the city who say we're tired of subsidizing the cost of upstate. I don't think it's in the cards. So it's an interesting, you know, sort of intellectual exercise, I guess. But I don't think that's really what's going to happen. And that being said, of course, you never know. New York State this year will be voting on whether or not it wants to have a constitutional convention. And that either, if it happens, could either exacerbate the tensions within the state or minimize them.
Okay. The governor has proposed free tuition at public colleges for people whose families make under $150,000. That going anywhere?
I think so. I mean, the governor has really staked out. There are certain areas where the governor plants his flag, and the legislature just sort of has to deal with it. He has planted his flag on this one. And as you point out, the governor's proposal would mean that up to a certain income, families that have family members in public colleges would be able to go for free. Right now, if you're poor, you can go to a public college for free. The state picks up the freight. The governor's proposal in the first year would essentially mean families between around $40,000 and $100,000 would be able to go for free. And under the governor's proposal, that would increase to $125,000 over the next couple years. And so it basically would help largely middle class, lower middle class, to some extent upper middle class families to attend a public college. But that creates all these new issues. So, for example, independent colleges don't like the idea because if they'd be put at a competitive disadvantage. The governor cuts programs for poor college students as part of the way to pay for this program, and that creates all sorts of problems. And then there's sort of technical issues about how the program works. All that stuff, I think, to some extent, I think that will get worked out, and we will see a version that looks more like the governor's than not, but it'll be a different version of what ultimately gets approved in the budget. I think the governor has staked out too much on this to let it fail.
Do you think that the words middle class, I hear that a lot from the governor these days, I think you were more likely to hear from his father, you know, about those people who had the least. But here is a guy, now younger Cuomo, who seems to be understanding that the voters are the middle class. And his rhetoric is filled with those words, middle class.
I mean, he's got to be careful, of course, because some of his proposals run counter to the narrative that he's establishing as sort of the champion of middle class New Yorkers. But you're right. I mean, the people who vote, I mean, as all of your educated listeners know, I mean, you're much more likely to vote the higher your income, the higher your educational status, you're much more likely to vote. And so poorer folks, the folks who actually need the most help, are the least likely to vote, and therefore their interests are not always represented in the debate over public policy. Now, that being said, the issue, particularly the thing, something like college affordability, that's a real problem. I mean, there's $1.2 trillion in outstanding college debt now across the country, second only to mortgages in personal debt. And it is a serious public policy problem that should be addressed. Now, you know, there's lots of different ways you can do it. Making tuition free is certainly an important component of trying to make that happen. And providing aid to the students who need the money is a helpful way to do it. Grants are cheaper to pay off than loans. And I think the governor sort of gets that, and he's trying to do something about it.
But when you step back and you take a look at presidential politics, Donald Trump, he made a point, I think, Well, let's leave out whether it was racist or not, that the middle class was getting screwed because the poor were getting everything. And you get the idea that Cuomo understands that also. It's the way that Trump got elected. He said to the middle class, lower middle class, you're getting hurt. And I'm going to stop that. Whether he does or not is another whole story. But it worked.
Yeah, I mean, breaking up, I mean, essentially pitting people against each other and sort of breaking up the Democratic working class union coalition is a way that Republicans can help get themselves elected. I mean, that's normally those are Democratic voters. The states that he won that gave him the Electoral College victory, not the popular vote victory, are states that had gone for Obama. And so it was a wedge issue that he used very effectively. Now, again, at the end of the day, public policy is what people understand. And, you know, whether or not the Trump administration delivers on its promises to those individuals, we'll see. Certainly, it's pretty early in the administration, the first 100 or so days. And so we don't know yet. But taking away the health insurance didn't seem like it was a good idea in terms of helping those people. We'll see what happens over the next few months.
Okay. It seems that public policy is the... Murray's making a statement.
I hope it's not about me.
It does. I think it is. The question is whether or not there is going to be a pay raise. Now, suppose that rolling their eyes and saying, oh, who cares about the stupid pay raise?
Apparently, but, Murray does.
Well, Murray does care about it. And he says, these guys are disgraceful. He was talking to me about it the other day. He said, these guys are disgraceful. There's all this public policy stuff, education aid, college aid. But in the end, they want a couple of measly $1,000 or they're not going to cooperate. How much is that part of the public policy debate that we're seeing now?
Well, I think some of the toxic relationships between the legislative branch and the executive branch are fueled by the fact that the legislators feel like the governor welched on a deal to get them a pay raise. 2 years ago, 2015, as part of the budget agreement, the governor and the legislature agreed to create a commission to look at the appropriate level of compensation for state lawmakers and commissioners of the executive branch. It was supposed to be independent, of course. It was sort of a joke. It was hardly independent. If you look closely, you could see the strings. But the commission sort of went about its business, had some public hearings, accepted testimony. And I think everyone expected, since lawmakers and the commissioners hadn't had a pay raise in almost 20 years, that this would be the year to do it. At the last minute, late last year, the governor's appointees, so-called independent, reacting to the governor's call that they shouldn't get a pay raise, killed the deal.
No, his guys on the commission, pardon me for interrupting,
yeah, sure.
But his guys on the commission basically did what they were told.
That's what it seems like.
Saying,
that's
okay,
yeah,
yeah.
I mean, there's no other way to view it. And,
yeah.
and that was the best evidence it wasn't independent in the first place. I mean, you know, to go 20 years without a pay raise, I think everybody who listens to this understands that that's not a good thing, and nobody should expect that to happen. But if you're going to set salaries somehow, it has to be done independently. It can't be the governor and the legislature wrangling out deals. That's where all this stuff comes from, and we think an independent commission is the way to do it. That's not what happened, and the governor pulled the rug out from under this, and I think that's part of the reason why the legislative branch is unhappy with him right now, is they feel like not only did they lose their pay raise, but he cannot be trusted. And it's hard to negotiate $160 billion budget agreements if you don't believe the guy across the table is somebody you can trust.
Let's go to Eric Schneiderman, who, the New York State Attorney General, is leading a coalition of 23 states, cities, and counties in opposing President Trump's executive order that just got done this week, that the administration described as paving the way to eliminating the Clean Power Plant rule. What's that about?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the Trump administration has declared war on science, I think. The Obama administration put this rule in place as a way to sort of reduce the amount of greenhouse gas emissions from certain types of power plants, and particularly coal. And when Trump was a candidate, he said, well, he's going to fire up the coal industry again and put all those coal miners back to work. And so this is a substantive way of doing that is to destroy the Obama administration's executive order. They did it through executive action to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, and it was part of the Paris Agreement as well. Now, I don't know how anyone who understands the science thinks that this is a good idea to make it easier for the United States to pump out greenhouse gas emissions when the planet's heating up. So Schneiderman and some of the other attorneys general across the country are bringing a court action against the president, My guess is this gets tied up in litigation for a while, and whether or not it even gets resolved during this first term of the Trump administration, or maybe only term, we'll see, I think remains to be seen. But that's what it's about. It's really about an attack on the environment. It goes hand in hand with the Trump administration's basically slashing of the EPA's budget. This is all about the view that economic activity is at odds with environmental protection, which, of course, makes no sense at all. But that is their view. And the world will pay the price for it.
Now, we know that Andrew Cuomo does not play in the sandbox well with his friends. Tom DiNapoli, Schneiderman, it goes back and forth. But has Schneiderman been very aggressive lately? Can we presume he's number two now by now in terms of if Andrew Cuomo runs for president, if he resigns, if he doesn't win, that Schneiderman is next up?
Well, I mean, that has been, I mean, that's the recent pattern in New York history, right? Elliot Spitzer was attorney general when Governor Pataki was governor, and he was the aspiring governor, AG. He then, of course, crashes and burns, but he's replaced by the attorney general that was attorney general when he was governor, Andrew Cuomo. Now, you know, prior to that, there was a guy named Bobby Abrams, who for a long time was going to be the next governor of the state of New York, and he never went anywhere. So, I mean, I think Schneiderman certainly is a statewide elected official who has developed some chops in terms of substantive policy and public relations, would be the best positioned Democrat to run for governor. If indeed the current governor either chose not to run or resign for whatever reason, but Lieutenant Governor Hochul would be certainly a reasonable candidate in the mix, as would the comptroller. So I don't think the path is clear, but it is certainly Schneiderman would certainly be considered, one of the leading contenders for the Democrats.
Well, I certainly agree with you about the comptroller, Tom DiNapoli, being a viable candidate. He's very popular. But does anybody even know who the lieutenant governor is?
Well, there is that. But she is, she is the lieutenant governor. And if the governor Cuomo decided to move on, his political apparatus may be there for her. I mean, she's been a loyal soldier. She's one of the top elected Democratic female office holders in the state.
But she's from Buffalo.
That's right.
You know, Democrats don't win if they're not in the five boroughs.
I can't remember the last time there was one that wasn't from the five boroughs. I absolutely agree. But, you know, she could certainly make a claim depending on how the politics of it all played out. But I would agree that Schneiderman is right up there at the beginning, at the top of the list.
If you were going to offer Preet Bharara, one of my great heroes, advice, he's going to NYU Law School. What would you say to him?
I think he should come to Albany and speak at the Lindo with you. I think that would be my advice to him.
Well, of course, he's done that before.
He was a U.S. attorney. Who knows what he would say now? He actually might be more newsworthy.
Right. Do you think that he has a position or potential in? He said of Springsteen that he was born to run.
Right.
I mean, if I were a New Yorker, which I'm not, I would certainly vote for the guy.
Well, look, most people don't know who he is. The polling tells you that it's roughly half the state, I guess, if not more, never heard of him. So he has that problem. He doesn't have a bully pulpit anymore from which to continue to make news. I assume the Democratic political leadership would rather see him vanish from the scene as compared to get elected, because he put a bunch of their associates in the pokey and tortured the existing governor. So I think the political forces would be arrayed against him. That being said, he certainly would have a claim to fame that none of the other potential candidates would have. And he's a shrewd guy. I mean, he's very smart. He's very charismatic and has a great sense of humor. So I think he would be an attractive candidate if he could raise the money and put together the political apparatus to do so. And having never run for anything and having probably the party not thrilled with him, that could be a problem.
Our Capital Connection with the great Blair Horner, Executive Director of New York Public Interest Research Group, NYPIRG. Blair, the man who's always on the front page of the New York Times, more perhaps than the headlines. Thanks so much for joining us, Blair. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Alan.
The Capital Connection is distributed with the cooperation of the public radio stations of New York State. David Gustina is the producer of The Capital Connection, a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio in Albany. Support for The Capital Connection comes from New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org.